Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I went for a long overdue haircut a few weeks ago to my local barber shop in Dunleary, which given the current circumstances was fortuitous, as I'd have otherwise been coming out of the crisis we now face looking like a balding hippie. As I waited my turn, I watched the owner empty his fish tank with a siphon which he sucked on periodically to ensure a decent flow. The fish seemed happy enough, even if the water appeared to have the colour and consistency of a good chicken stock. He complained about the filter and its efficiency, assuring myself and the mother of the boy, getting a blade won all over, that he had only cleaned it out a week previously. I didn't doubt him. As I said, the fish seemed perfectly content. And it so happens that I'm an expert of sorts on just how easy it is to kill a tankful of healthy tropical fish. One Easter many years ago, when I was about 10, my parents came home from a holiday with a Toblerone egg for me, about as big as a medium-sized dog. For the entirety of Holy Week, I looked at it with desire as it sat on the table in the good room, trying to imagine the thickness of the chocolate, what the egg might contain inside, and how quickly I could eat it before my six older siblings took notice. Sunday arrived, and I didn't even make it halfway back upstairs with my egg before being intercepted by my mother. Under no circumstances was I allowed near that egg until after 12:30 Mass, she told me. By this stage, I'd already removed it from its packaging, but grudgingly, I put the egg down on the nearest flat surface, which happened to be the cover of my brother Paul's fish tank. Sharing a room with a brother 6 years your senior, I've always suspected, must be like sharing a prison cell with an organised crime boss. While a certain degree of benevolence was shown, mainly due to the fact I knew most of his secrets, such as where he hid his fags, I was never under any illusion as to whose room it really was. The record player, the records, the shelf space, even the walls, with their posters of AC/DC and Kim Wilde were his. More importantly, the aquarium, 3 feet long and filled with more than 50 tropical fish, from guppies and neons to long-whiskered suckers, was most definitely his. With the same attention to detail he later brought to cooking in his career as a chef, my brother would tend to his shoal lovingly and meticulously. He monitored the water levels. He installed the correct bulbs in the tank's lid. He cleaned the filters and pumps regularly. There was even a primitive kind of feng shui at work in his positioning of a plastic pirate ship and palm trees to further enhance the fish's living conditions in our bedroom. He carefully fed them their breakfast and dinner of fish flakes each day, never too much, he explained to me with authority, as overfeeding would kill them. I often gazed at the tank from my lower bunk, wondering what would happen if I tipped the whole tub of flakes. Would they slowly expand until suddenly exploding? Or would they just get fat like our two dogs? But the dietary habits of suckerfish wasn't what preoccupied my mind that Easter Sunday morning at the back of the Church of the Assumption, Dorky. Rather, the 2 pounds of Swiss chocolate I planned to stuff my face with as soon as I got out of there. Hymns finished, I sprinted home ahead of everyone else and made straight for the bedroom. I was confronted with a crime scene. The egg had disappeared from where it had stood on top of the fish tank, leaving only a crumpled mess of golden tinfoil in its place. Closer inspection revealed a brown mess oozing down the sides of the lid, but I still hadn't comprehended the true nature of the crime until my brother entered the room a few moments later. Trapped beneath a slab of solidified chocolate, all 50 plus of his treasured tropical fish floated dead in the tank. Who knew an Easter egg left on an aquarium lid in which were embedded several superheated light bulbs would melt in less than an hour, perfectly covering every square inch of surface area and depriving the fish of oxygen. Who knew fish needed oxygen to survive? Not me, anyway. How I survived to recount this story and get my €8 haircut nearly 40 years later owes much to my mother's prompt arrival home from Mass before my brother could properly strangle me. And while my memory of the subsequent weeks is hazy, we continued to share that room for a number of years after that, and in due course, the fish tank was replenished. Some days after my trip to the barber, I arrived home from work to be greeted by my wife and youngest daughter, excitedly ordering me to close my eyes and follow them into the kitchen. After walking me intentionally into a door and table, they finally let me open my eyes to discover their secret. A small fish tank with a plastic palm tree and a single shining goldfish.
Easter 1916. And while some of us were preparing to fight and die for Ireland, the French composer Maurice Ravel received an Easter egg in the post. Ravel was well established as a composer at that stage. He'd enlisted in the First World War and he'd been sent to Verdun in the northeast of France as a driver. But there he transported munitions, often under heavy German fire, in his truck, which he nicknamed Adelaide. France had set up a sort of pen pal system whereby women would write letters to soldiers at the front for moral and material support. These women were called marraines de guerre, literally godmothers of war. And in April 1916, Ravel's marraine de guerre, who happened to be the mother of one of his piano pupils, sent him a care package, an Easter egg. She'd already sent him bouillabaisse, lobster, asparagus and mayonnaise in other care packages. I hope Ravel appreciated being French on those occasions, because if he'd been Irish, he'd no doubt have been sent a lump of hairy bacon and a miraculous medal. Imagine for a moment, wherever you're socially isolating yourself today, that the sun is beaming down from a cloudless azure sky and you're driving down the coast road, the Corniche, from Biarritz in the southwest of France. The road twists and rises and dips as you head towards the Spanish border. You pass through Saint-Jean-de-Luz, you cross the Nivelle River, and there on the right, a beautiful little Basque village called Cibourg. And down at the harbour, at number 12, Quai de la Nivelle, the great French composer Maurice Ravel was born on the 7th of March, 1875. I grew up near another border, in Newry. The first time I ever heard an orchestra live was the Ulster Orchestra playing Ravel's Bolero. I remember this long, twisting melody that never seemed to end, getting louder and louder till a big, noisy finale. I loved it. And I'd seen pictures of this dapper, white-haired guy in his tailored dark suit smoking a cigarette. And Ravel looked cool. Maybe that's where my lifelong love affair with France came from. I'm not sure, to be honest. I mean, we never went there on childhood holidays. That was Galway. But I distinctly remember a choir trip to Paris in 1986. I was 16. I stuck an Edith Piaf cassette in my Walkman, doused myself in Drakkar Noir, and bought a taupe-coloured polo neck with batwing sleeves in Galerie Lafayette. Formative and formidable. I studied music at school, and guess what? Ravel's string quartet was one of the set works. And still to this day, it brings me right into a silent film filled with elegance, beauty and heartbreak and French people walking impossibly fast. I wanted to read more about Paris, the legendary cafes of Montmartre, Eric Satie in his grey velvet suits, Renoir, little Toulouse-Lautrec, absinthe and decadence. Ravel's family lived just below Montmartre. They left the village of Cibourg and moved up to the Big Smoke when he was very young. But his mother was Basque, and he always held on tightly to that Basque heritage. And the Basque country fascinated me. A people who defined themselves regardless of internationally recognised borders. I admired the fact that their Basque language, Euskara, remains proudly unconnectable to any other European language. Nothing prepares the innocent tourist coming into the Basque country for the first time for that proliferation of X's and K's and Z's in their place names. Similarly, Ravel, in his music, created a patchwork of distinctive and vivid musical colours that you just didn't hear anywhere else. All of this bubbled away quietly inside my own head for years. But what crystallised it for me was a bit of human mitochondrial genetics. Now, you weren't expecting that. As far as I understand, most of your DNA is stored in the nucleus of your cells, but some of it is stored in another bit, your mitochondria. And while the information in the nucleus comes from both your parents, the stuff that's stored in your mitochondria comes only from your mother. Human mitochondrial genetics traces your maternal line right back to a prehistoric woman, who may or may not have existed, but that's not important right now. It groups all Europeans into seven distinct clans, and at the head of each one, the clan mother, Tara, Jasmine, Ulrika, and Velda, amongst others. Out of the blue one day, someone came to our work and invited a group of us to take part in a free mitochondrial genetic experiment. Now, this is years before Who Do You Think You Are? It won't hurt, they said. We just need to capture your DNA and it'll tell us something about where your people came from. A simple swab of the inside of the cheek and results in a few weeks. By the time the call came for the big reveal, we sat in a circle like a self-help group, and it turned out my clan was Clan Helena. She was born some 20,000 years ago, but this was the bit that really stopped me in my tracks. Clan Helena, the maternal line of my DNA, was most concentrated in southwestern France and northern Spain. The Basque region. That's where my people came from. So for all we know, that suave, debonair and talented musician, me, could be related to Maurice Ravel. I can't see me driving that coast road to the Basque country anytime soon, but in whichever room in the house I choose to unwrap my eagerly anticipated Easter egg this year, I'll be thinking of my great Uncle Maurice.
The village where my parents live is near empty at the best of times. Social distancing comes naturally. But there is an exception. At Easter, people surge onto the streets as the diaspora return home from the cities to celebrate with their parents and grandparents in the pueblo where they grew up. Here in Ireland, we always celebrated Easter Sunday as a release from the drabness of Lent and the dourness of Holy Week. But in Spain, and particularly in Andalusia, the day, Resurrection Sunday, is rather the culmination of a week of pageantry. Each day of Semana Santa, Holy Week, the locals gather in confraternities to liberate Christ and the Virgin from the local church. They wear eerie, pointed hoods and matching cloaks. Some go barefoot. Spanish religious sculpture is distinctive for its hyper-realism. The sculptures are vividly coloured, almost kitsch. They can be disturbingly lifelike as they bleed and weep. These are borne aloft on biers by the penitents and paraded through the streets, sometimes with sombre reverence, other times to ecstatic cheers. We arrived in the village in February, on a short but health-enforced break. We signed the children into the village school and set ourselves up for 2 months. The house we rented was bare but functional. The phone signal was poor, but the bar around the corner had Wi-Fi and I could work from there. And from the small terrace on the roof, We could see the Mediterranean to the south and the mountains on the three other sides. The village sits on the edge of a national park, with trails taking you quickly into the hills. The streets smell of jasmine. Church bells mark the quarter hours. So as Italy locked down and Madrid began to succumb, the village felt a haven from the unfolding crisis. I bumped into Antonio, the local grocer, one afternoon in the plaza. "What about this virus?" I asked him. "I hear the rains are coming," he said gruffly, gesturing to the skies. "They'll wash it away." I didn't have much faith in his virology, but I did have faith in the villagers' indomitable sense of stubborn isolation. So as the inevitable lockdown loomed, we decided to stay where we were. The village's narrow, whitewashed streets have survived 700 years of conflict, famine, and plague. It seemed like a good place to see out a pandemic. I assumed the locals would approach the restrictions with a healthy degree of discretion. But as the first week of lockdown progressed, it became clear that I was badly wrong. The lockdown did not admit of local variations. The locals did not contemplate applying discretion. Walking the dog meant walking the dog. It did not encompass jogging past other people walking their dogs. It dawned on me that lockdown in this village would not simply mean weeks or months of quiet time, enjoying a rural idyll. It would mean confinement in a barely equipped holiday rental, allowed outside only for necessities, the children not allowed outside at all. It would mean family exercise routines on the roof. Despite the view and the sun, that seemed closer to prison than to nature. It would mean the five of us fighting endlessly over two phones, relying on an erratic phone signal for work, YouTube, Netflix, Roblox and Class Dojo, occasionally slipping out to stand outside the shuttered bar around the corner and borrow its weak Wi-Fi. But my parents were there, a few cobble streets over. And though those streets were quieter now, they were not eerie like the empty cities we could see online. The village's soundscape of church bells and birdsong remained the same. When Simon Coveney announced the imminent closure of the Spanish air routes, we bought flights, just in case, for us and for my parents. That whole week, we argued it out into the small hours. How long might this last? Where would the kids be happier? If one of my parents did get ill, which health system would they be better off in? Where would they be happier? What would it be like if one of them fell ill and there was nothing at all we could do about it from Ireland? I thought we could work it out like a piece of moral calculus, that there was objectively a right decision. But ultimately, there was only a selfish decision. We wanted to be at home. We wanted our girls to be at home. We wanted my parents to come home with us, because then we wouldn't have to worry. But they, too, wanted to be at home. And their home is in the village now, where, even in a lockdown, there will never be a shortage of birdsong, or church bells, or sunlight. We devised a way for the children to hug their grandparents goodbye through a towel, and my mother gave us face masks she had made with kitchen paper and twine, following a tutorial on YouTube. By the time we'd finished our two-week isolation upon returning home, the whole country was in isolation. But it is a gentler, more humane lockdown here, and we are relishing the daily family walks by the canal. Today, if the weather holds, we'll have a barbecue in the garden, and my parents will have lunch on their roof, looking out on the sea and the mountains. And then, like every other family in this country and theirs, we'll take out our screens and call each other. And though we'll miss them, and they us, I think we'll all know that we're each in the right place to be during a crisis. At home. We'll be right back.
When we were growing up, Smarties were the chocolate of choice in our house. Every time Ma went to the rotunda, she came back shaking boxes of Smarties for her other kids. A clever woman, she'd hand the new baby over to me Dad before she crossed the threshold of our house, rattle Smarties, and we'd all come running to get the sweets. And oh yeah, see the new baby. Ma came home 9 times with a new baby from the rotunda. She knew what she was doing. It's no wonder that we're all stone mad for babies. For us, they equate with sweet, colourful, chocolatey joy. Easter time was best. Holy Week, we'd be off school and all the talk on our estate was of Easter eggs. We'd be playing curbs and rowing over buttons versus Smarties. We'd be firing pebbles from the quarry onto the corrugated roof of Premier Dairies and discussing the merits of keeping your Easter egg in the fridge. Or we'd be climbing the trees over the River Talca and wondering who would keep their Easter egg the longest before cracking it open and gobbling it up. At tea time, there'd be more talk of Easter eggs. Me da would say, "We never had that malarkey of chocolate Easter eggs when I was a child. We got hard-boiled eggs after the Easter Mass and decorated them with soot from the fire. Chocolate eggs, me fu." Then the ma would weigh in. "Ah, now, when we were kids, times were harder for the Easter Bunny. Maybe he might bring our kids some Smarties Easter eggs, if they're good like." Then Ma would glare over the kitchen table and stare at me. "Of course, I'm not sure the Easter Bunny will come to any bold girls who'd be firing rocks at the dairy roof or climbing trees over rivers." And that put manners on me. Well, at least for the rest of Holy Week. The Easter Bunny must have had a soft spot for bold girls, because every Easter morning I'd wake up and there'd be a Smarties Easter egg at the end of me bunk bed. We weren't allowed to eat our eggs until after Mass, the Easter feast of lamb, spuds and veg, and the car journey up to the pine forests in the Dublin Mountains. I don't know why, but if the weather was with us, we loved to build a fire by the stream, boil up water in a billy can, make tea and eat our Easter eggs in the fresh spring air. Most times, the weather was with us. The Easter Bunny still brings Easter eggs, and in my house, he brings Smarties eggs to everyone. Our sons still love the surprise of the little boxes of brightly coloured Smarties. I also happen to know, for the last 2 years, the Easter Bunny has brought a Smarties Easter egg to my ma in her nursing home. Ma lives with dementia. She's not great at remembering things that happen in the now, but she can remember things from the long ago very well. And when she sees that Smarties Easter egg at the bottom of her bed, her eyes just light up. And when we take her to the pine forest, build a fire, drink tea in the spring air, and gobble up our Smarties Easter eggs, well, it's like me old Ma comes back to me. She tells me to mind the fire and be careful by the water. She is my mother. I am her daughter. But this Easter is different for all of us. We cannot get to Mass and make journeys to the pine forest or anywhere else for that matter. But I know the Easter Bunny will still come and bring lovely chocolate Easter eggs. I even know the Easter Bunny has a way of bouncing into lockdown nursing homes, and he'll leave a Smarty Easter egg at the end of our ma's bed. This Easter Sunday, I have to do what I have been doing for the last 37 days. I have to ring my ma at the nurse's station. We can have our chat and then end our call with a rousing rendition of Vera Lynn's "We'll Meet Again." Sometimes those wondrous warriors, ma's carers, nurses and staff at Malahide Care Choice, they even join us for the chorus. But after, I'm going to do what I've never done before. I'm going to save me Smarties Easter egg. I'm going to wait for the day I can take my ma out of her nursing home, drive her up the Dublin mountains, build a fire by the stream in the pine forest, drink our tea in the fresh air, and share a chocolate Easter egg together. Happy Easter, ma. And to all those cocooning at home, in nursing homes or hospitals, we love you and miss you very much.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Last November, on Hailuto Island in the gulf between Finland and Scotland, there was a rare weather movement. The ice was rolled over by wind and water, forming thousands of eggs all along the shore. Some as big as an ostrich egg, others the size of a hen's, or as small as a swallow's. The formation of these ice eggs requires a near-perfect set of meteorological conditions. Not too warm, not too cold, not too windy, not too still. Risto Matilla stumbled upon the site and took a photograph with the sun lighting up the sea and the layers of ice eggs spread along 30 metres of Finland's Marjani beach. Under the sun, the eggs are blue, pink, fawn, dun, palest green and ice white. These eggs were forming around the same time that the virus was forming. The virus that probably needed rare conditions and combinations to form in a city and then spread out rapidly. But my mind is not preoccupied with the virus just now. My mind is full of music, because I've been watching a video of Nick Squires playing Bach in the rain, in the rain. Squires was booked to play cello in the Alani String Quartet at a wedding on a sprawling estate in Wiltshire. But an unexpected deluge meant that all the music had to be cancelled. Squires couldn't bear that the couple wouldn't hear their special piece. So he took his 180-year-old cello into the nearest neoclassical temple and had his friend film the performance. Somehow everything just clicked, he said. The acoustics are magic and the rain was incredible. The combination of rain and musicianship and his need to make an offering created moments that are being cherished by this wedding couple and millions of other people tuning into the film on YouTube. And while I was on there, I listened to Natalie Merchant singing her poem Motherland. And Hozier was singing for Childline on The Late Late Show. And Miriam O'Callaghan dedicated his last song, The Parting Glass, to the health worker who gave her precious life serving others. And even with the danger to their own lives, doctors and nurses at Beaumont Hospital are sticking printouts of their faces to their personal protective equipment to lift their patients' spirits. Sean Corcoran made a sand art tribute to give thanks to all of the people working in our hospitals, and it made the RTÉ news. He has been making sand art on the Copper Coast for many years, his art an offering to us and to the sea. Artist friends are making masks that are tiny works of art. Mary Lincoln, our beloved potter, is gathering local sand to make heart boxes with a red heart on top that you can remove and place inside the clay box when your own heart needs cocooning. One of our elders, on hearing that she needed to be cocooned, wondered if she was going to turn into a butterfly. Another, who is a former ballet dancer, danced the sugar plum fairy in her garden, her daughter dancing with her at the gate. April is Poetry Month, and every day I am offered gifts of poems and also paintings, films, music, dance, photographs. and this morning I opened the back door to find a bottle of fresh milk from our neighbours, the Keatings, and their cows. Restaurants are offering food to overworked hospital staff. Food suppliers are working flat out to keep the shelves packed. And we treasure even more our local suppliers of honey, vegetables and cheese, our farmers and fishermen. All over the world, this virus has triggered a wave of community action. Families baking together, growing food, online play and yoga for children, balcony bingo, balcony singing, fashion designers making protective suits, an airline flying stranded Irish people home for free. So much happening locally and globally as we help each other through this shared predicament. And looking up at the supermoon, I imagine that each person who comes forward to help has an egg that formed around a piece of grit or sand, like the ice eggs in Finland formed themselves. And each egg needed particular weather, the role of wave and air and sea, all that happened in that person's life, the way they were nurtured, their particular talents, but also the hurts and losses that led to their gifts of empathy and selflessness. Some offerings are as tiny and important as a hummingbird's egg. Others are ostrich size. And there's a great urgency to offer these eggs now, before the ice melts, to each other, to the motherland, to the risen Christ.
On this morning's programme, we heard Eggs and Fish by Alan Finnegan, Me and Maurice Ravel by John Toll, Church Bells and Birdsong was by Colin Murphy, Smarty's Easter Eggs and the Pine Forest was by Rachel Hegarty, and Ice Eggs was by Lanny O'Hanlon. The music on the programme was Three Little Fishies sung by The Smoothies, String Quartet in F Major, the second movement by Ravel, played by the Ebene Quartet. Dios te salve, Maria, from the Misa Rosiera, sung by the Royal Artistic Association of Valverde del Camino. And We'll Meet Again by Vera Lynn. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey, and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.